Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, March 29 of 2024. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger, and here is our first story. Front page Globe Gazette, financial crime, FTX founder is sentenced, is the headline. Bankman freed gets 25 years for running massive crypto fraud. The dateline is New York, written by Ken Sweet and Larry Neumeister of the Associated Press. Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced Thursday to 25 years in prison for a massive fraud affecting hundreds of thousands of customers that unraveled with the collapse of FTX, once one of the world's most popular platforms for exchanging digital currency. The U.S. District Judge Louis A. Kaplan delivered a blistering analysis of Bankman-Fried and his crimes before announcing a sentence that was half of what prosecutors sought and less than a quarter of the 105 years recommended by the court's probation officer. There is absolutely no doubt that Mr. Bankman-Fried's name right now is pretty much mud around the world, Kaplan said of the 32-year-old man who once seemed atop the cryptocurrency world before his businesses collapsed in November of 2022, leaving customers, investors, and lenders short more than $11 billion, which the judge ordered him to forfeit. He was convicted in November of fraud and conspiracy, a dramatic fall from a crest of success that included a Super Bowl advertisement and celebrity endorsements from stars like quarterback Tom Brady, basketball star Stephen Curry, and comedian Larry David. Kaplan imposed the sentence in the same Manhattan courtroom where, 4 months previously, Bankman-Fried testified that he intended to revolutionize the emerging cryptocurrency market with his innovative and altruistic ideas, not steal. The judge said Bankman-Fried repeatedly committed perjury when he told lies from the witness stand. Kaplan said the sentence reflected that there is a risk that this man will be in prison or in position to do something very bad in the future. And it's not a trivial risk at all, he said. He added that it was for the purpose of disabling him to the extent that can appropriately be done for a significant period of time. Kaplan said he would advise the Federal Bureau of Prisons to send Bankman-Fried to a medium security prison near San Francisco because his notoriety, his association with vast wealth, his autism, and social awkwardness are likely to make him especially vulnerable at a high security facility. Assistant U.S. Attorney Nicholas Roos recommended a prison sentence of 40 to 50 years, saying it was the only way to ensure, quote, the defendant doesn't do it again. The defendant victimized tens of thousands of people and companies across several continents over a period of multiple years, end quote, the prosecutor said in the courtroom. Prosecutors said Bankman-Fried misappropriated billions of dollars to fuel his quest for influence and dominance in the new industry and had illegally used money from FTX depositors to cover his expenses, which included luxury properties in the Caribbean, bribes of Chinese officials, and private planes. Kaplan agreed with prosecutors Thursday that Bankman-Fried should not get leniency just because some investors and customers might get some of their losses back. He noted that customers lost about $8 billion, investors lost $1.7 billion, and lenders were shorted by $1.3 billion. Given a chance to speak, Bankman-Fried stood and apologized in a rambling 20-minute statement saying, quote, a lot of people feel really let down, and they were very let down, and I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry about what happened at every stage, end quote. But he went on and he added, my useful life is probably over. It's been over for a while now from before my arrest, he said. Bankman-Fried seemed to briefly get emotional as he spoke, expressing regret about a lot of mistakes, but casting some of the blame onto others. The judge later criticized those remarks, saying he expressed never a word of remorse for the commission of terrible crimes. Defense lawyer Mark Mukasey said his client was misunderstood Sam was not a ruthless financial serial killer who set out every morning to hurt people, Mukasey said. Sam Bankman-Fried doesn't make decisions with malice in his heart. He makes decisions with math in his head, he said. Bankman-Fried's attorneys, friends, and family urged leniency, saying he was unlikely to reoffend again. They also said FTX's investors have largely recovered their funds, a claim disputed by bankruptcy lawyers, FTX, and its creditors. Mr. Bankman-Fried continues to live a life of delusion, wrote John Ray, the CEO of FTX, who has been cleaning up the bankruptcy or the bankrupt company. The businesses he left on November 11, 2022 was neither solvent nor safe, he said. 2 weeks ago, Mukasey attacked a probation office recommendation of 105 years in prison, saying a sentence of that length would be grotesque and barbaric. He urged the judge to sentence Bankman-Fried to a term of 5 to 6.5 years in prison. Bankman-Fried was worth billions of dollars on paper as the co-founder and CEO of FTX, which was the second largest cryptocurrency exchange in the world at one time. FTX allowed investors to buy dozens of virtual currencies, from Bitcoin to more obscure ones like Shibu Inu coin. Flush with billions of dollars of investors' cash, Bankman-Fried took out a Super Bowl advertisement to promote his business and bought the naming rights to an arena in Miami. But the collapse of cryptocurrency prices in 2022 took its toll on FTX and led to its downfall. Second story, which is right below the lead story, was House Speaker facing uphill battle to secure aid for Kyiv. Johnson is facing a threat to his own leadership position as he mulls push for funding. It's an Associated Press article written by Stephen Groves. Dateline is Washington. For over a month, House Speaker Mike Johnson has sat on a funding package that would send desperately needed ammunition and weaponry to Ukraine, mulling how best to gain a grasp of what is expected to be a difficult lift in the House. The Republican Speaker has indicated he will attempt to push for approval of tens of billions in wartime funding for Ukraine as well as Israel once the House returns in April, yet it will be perhaps his most difficult task since he took the Speaker's gavel late last year. We'll turn our attention to it, and we won't delay on that, the Louisiana representative said of the Ukraine package at a news conference last week. Still, Johnson has waited to act at a time when Russia is renewing its missile attacks on Kyiv. In Ukraine's eastern regions, soldiers are running low on ammunition as they attempt to hold off a surge of Russian soldiers to the front lines. European leaders and analysts are warning the conflict could grow into a much larger clash than involves NATO allies and direct American military involvement if Russia prevails in Ukraine. Johnson is facing dilemmas himself in Congress. Should funding for Ukraine's government be loans or a typical grant? Should the $95 billion package that the Senate approved for Ukraine, Israel, and other allies be handled as one or broken into pieces? And how decisively should he push for the House to act when his own leadership position is being threatened? Representative Gregory Meeks, the top Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, called it devastating that the House has departed for a two-week break with the aid package left unresolved. He, along with many Democrats, called on Johnson to allow a vote on a Senate-approved bill. But hardline conservatives in the House, adamantly opposed to aid for Ukraine, are already frustrated with Johnson's willingness to work with Democrats to pass legislation, so much so that it could cost him his job, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a far-right Republican from Georgia, has filed a motion to vacate Johnson as Speaker and warned him not to put Ukraine funding on the House floor. And meanwhile, an old guard of Republican defense hawks has put increasing pressure on Johnson to advance an aid package in some form. Most Democrats have indicated support for the Senate-passed legislation. However, a growing number of Democrats have raised concerns about Israel's deadly campaign in Gaza and a significant number of them are expected to oppose any funding for offensive weaponry for Israel. The dynamic leaves Johnson with a shifting and unpredictable House at a time when he will need to win a broad bipartisan support. Before becoming Speaker, Johnson was deeply skeptical of approving funding for Ukraine and voted repeatedly against it. But now, occupying one of the most powerful positions in Washington, Johnson is poised to become a crucial ally for Kyiv at a time when Americans' commitments abroad are in doubt. We understand the role that America plays in the world. We understand the importance of sending a strong signal to the world that we stand by our allies, and we cannot allow terrorists and tyrants to march through the globe, Johnson said. Fond of quoting former President Ronald Reagan, Johnson has repeatedly cited peace through strength as one of his guiding principles. In private, he has indicated he will work towards a vote on Ukraine aid once the House returns in April. According to two people who discussed the private conversations on the condition of anonymity, but he has revealed little about how he intends to do it. One idea Johnson has raised is splitting the funding for Ukraine and Israel into separate votes, which could allow him to navigate the fractures in support for the two countries between Republicans and Democrats. Senior Republicans are also working on a package that would loan Ukraine money to keep its government operating. Most of the money in the package would be allocated for purchasing weaponry from U.S. defense manufacturers, then sending them to Ukraine. The group of GOP defense hawks has also advanced legislation called the Rebuilding Economic Prosperity and Opportunity for Ukrainians, or REPO Act, which would allow the U.S. to tap frozen Russian central bank assets to compensate Ukraine for damages from the invasion. I would like to be doing it as soon as possible. I think the situation in Ukraine is dire, said Representative Michael McCaul, who was leading the push as the Republican chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee, in an interview on CBS's Face the Nation. For now, Green has not asked that the motion immediately be brought up for a vote, meaning that it could remain little more than a threat. Meanwhile, the mood in Kyiv has grown tense as the city withstands missile attacks and officials await word from Washington on approval of the aid, said Shelby Magid, M-A-G-I-D, deputy director of the Eurasian Center at the Atlantic Council, which advocates for American cooperation with Europe. So many Ukrainians know the names of members of Congress and the different procedures now, she said during a trip to Kyiv last week. Their lives depend on it. Moving to page 3, headline says Maryland will get $60 million. Barges with cranes on the way to site to help reopen shipping lane. Associated Press article written by Lee Skeen, S-K-E-N-E, and Brian Witte, W-I-T-T-E. Dateline is Baltimore. Maryland Governor Wes Moore warned Thursday of a very long road ahead to recover from the loss of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge as the Biden administration approved $60 million in immediate federal aid after the deadly collapse. Massive barges carrying cranes streamed toward the site to begin the challenging work of removing twisted metal and concrete as a first step toward reopening a key shipping route blocked by the wreckage of the span. Moore promised that the best minds in the world were working on plans to clear the debris, move the cargo ship that rammed into the bridge from the channel, recover the bodies of the four remaining workers presumed dead, and investigate what went wrong. Government is working hand in hand with industry to investigate the area, including the wreck, and remove the ship, said Moore, a Democrat who said quick aid is needed to lay the foundation for a rapid recovery. This work is not going to take hours. This work is not going to take days. This work is not going to take weeks, Moore said. We have a very long road ahead of us. An official said Thursday that two massive barges with cranes were on their way to the spot where the bridge crossed the Patapsco, P-A-T-A-P-S-C-O, Patapsco River, and were expected to arrive soon. The collapse happened when the powerless cargo ship struck a pillar supporting the bridge early through Tuesday. Divers recovered the bodies of two men in a pickup truck near the bridge's middle span Wednesday, but officials said they have to start clearing the wreckage before anyone could reach the bodies of four other missing workers. We are not moving from a recovery mode to a we are now moving from a recovery mode to a salvage operation. Because of the superstructure surrounding what we believe are the vehicles and the amount of concrete and debris, divers are no longer able to safely navigate or operate around that, Colonel Roland L. Butler, Jr., superintendent of Maryland State Police, said at a news conference Wednesday. We have exhausted all search efforts in the areas around this wreckage, and based on sonar scans, we firmly believe that the vehicles are encased in the superstructure and concrete, Butler said. National Transportation Safety Board officials boarded the ship, the Dali, D-A-L-I, to recover information from its electronics and paper work and to interview the captain and other crew members. Investigators shared a preliminary timeline of events before the crash, which federal and state officials said appeared to be an accident. And another article on page 3 of the Gazette. Headline is, Johnson will forward Mayorkas impeachment. Action against cabinet member has little chance in the Senate. Another Associated Press article, Dateline is Washington. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, indicated Thursday he will send articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate shortly after Congress returns to Washington next month. The Republican Speaker said he would send the two articles on April 10. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York, plans to swear in senators as jurors in the trial the next day, his office said. The House impeached Mayorkas on a razor-thin party line vote in February, but Johnson delayed sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate while Congress addressed funding for the government. Impeachment for Mayorkas, who would be the first cabinet secretary to receive the punishment in almost 150 years, is expected to quickly fizzle in the Democratic-controlled Senate. Republicans took the action against Mayorkas to rebuke his handling of the nation's southern border. Critics, including some Republicans, say the House did not demonstrate that the cabinet secretary's actions reached the Constitution's bar of high crimes and misdemeanors. And right next to that article is this one, Russian veto ends UN monitoring of North Korea. Another Associated Press article, Dateline is the United Nations. A veto Thursday by Russia ended monitoring of UN sanctions against North Korea over its nuclear program, prompting Western accusations that Moscow seeks to avoid scrutiny as it allegedly violates the sanctions to buy weapons from Pyongyang for its war in Ukraine. Russia's turnaround on the UN monitoring reflects how Moscow's growing animosity with the U.S. and its Western allies since the start of the Ukraine war has made it difficult to reach consensus on even issues where there has been longstanding agreement. The veto came during a vote on a UN Security Council resolution that would have extended the mandate of a panel of experts monitoring sanctions on North Korea for a year, but which will now halt its operation when its current mandate expires at the end of April. The vote in the 15-member council, with 13 in favor, Russia against, and China abstaining, has no impact on the actual sanctions against North Korea, which remain in force. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby condemned the veto as a reckless action. That undermines sanctions imposed on North Korea. Another article, Russia may target bases with jets for Ukraine. This dateline is Kiev. Russian President Vladimir Putin scoffed at the possibility of his country launching an attack on a NATO member, but warned that any Western airbase hosting U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets slated for deployment in Ukraine would be a legitimate target for Kremlin forces. Their statements about our alleged intention to attack Europe after Ukraine is sheer nonsense, Putin said late Wednesday, referring to warnings in the U.S. and Western Europe that Russia could turn its sights on other countries unless it stopped. He noted the U.S. defense budget is more than 10 times higher than Russia's. In view of that, are we going to wage a war against NATO? It's ravings, he told military pilots during a visit to an air base. Ukraine awaits the delivery of F-16s from Western partners, and its pilots have been training in the West to fly them. Man charged in Illinois, rampage that killed four. Dateline is Chicago. 22-year-old man was charged with four counts of first-degree murder in a frenzied stabbing and beating rampage that left four people dead in a northern Illinois city, authorities said Thursday. Christian Soto also was charged with seven counts of attempted murder and home invasion with a dangerous weapon following Wednesday's attack in Rockford. Seven people were injured. Court and jail records show Soto appeared in court briefly Thursday afternoon and remained held without bond. He is next due in court Tuesday when a judge will determine if he stays in jail pending trial. Three people remained hospitalized Thursday, officials said. The other four were treated and released, Rockford Police Chief Carla Redd said. Authorities released little information about Soto. Redd said he acted alone and police did not know his motive for the attacks. Here's a couple, three articles briefly. This is from Georgia. The charges against Donald Trump in the Georgia election interference case seek to criminalize political speech and conduct that the First Amendment protects, a lawyer for Trump argued Thursday. A prosecutor countered the Trump's statements, or countered that Trump's statements are not protected because they were integral to criminal activity. House Republicans on Thursday invited President Joe Biden to testify before Congress in their months-long impeachment inquiry into the Biden family businesses. So far, it has not produced hard evidence of wrongdoing while Biden was in public office. And, excuse me, the U.S. economy grew at a solid 3.4% annual pace from October through December, the government said Thursday, which is up from an earlier estimate. Tennessee Republican Governor Bill Lee signed off Thursday on Tennessee's repeal of police traffic stop reforms made in Memphis after the fatal beating of Tyree Wood Nichols by officers in January of 2023, despite pleas from Nicholas' parents to GOP lawmakers and the governor. And Russia's top investigative body said Thursday another suspect was detained as an accomplice in last week's attack on a suburban Moscow concert hall that killed 143 people. And finally, the number of U.S. tuberculosis cases in 2023 was the highest in a decade. 40 states reported an increase, and rates were up among all age groups, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said. Thursday, more than 9,600 cases were reported. Those were Associated Press articles. Going to move into sports now. The men's NCAA tournament. March Madness is among us. And just not much to say about it, but we do know that Illinois scored 72 points last night, and Iowa State scored 69. So Iowa State is out of the tournament. Illinois continues on. So that's the way that fell together. Clemson surprises Arizona in Sweet 16. Associated Press wrote this. Chase Hunter scored 18 points and converted a three-point play with 25.7 seconds remaining, and Clemson advanced to the Elite Eight for the second time in school history, beating Arizona 77-72 in a West Region semifinal on Thursday. We have confidence in our team, said Clemson head coach Brad Brownell, who is in the Elite Eight for the first time in a 22-year coaching career that includes one previous Sweet 16 appearance in 14 seasons with the Tigers. I've got an older team. These guys have seen a lot, done a lot, and experienced success. And so just really happy that they were able to withstand it, and we executed some things really well down the stretch. And we go on over here to Alabama, 89, and North Carolina, 87. Number four, Alabama, North Carolina by 2 points. Grant Nelson converted a go-ahead three-point play with 38 seconds remaining, and the Crimson Tide, 24-11, beat the Tar Heels, 29-8, to reach the Elite Eight for the second time in school history. Nelson finished with a season high 24 points, 19 in the second half, and he blocked R.J. Davis's attempt at a tying layup after giving Alabama the lead. Ryland Griffin added 19 points, tying his career high with 5 3-pointers, and Aaron Estrada also scored 19. And we move over here to the East Regional, where UConn, number one UConn, 82, and number five San Diego State, 52. Stephen Castle had 16 points and 11 rebounds for the Huskies, 34-3, as the defending NCAA champion advanced to the Elite Eight with another double-digit win, beating the Aztecs, 26-11, in a rematch of last year's title game. So that's kind of a wrap up the NCAA there. Here's a little hockey news from the Associated Press. Tyler Bertuzzi scored twice to give him 6 goals in 7 games. Joseph Woll made 24 saves in a bounce-back performance, and the Toronto Maple Leafs defeated the Washington Capitals 5-1 on Thursday night. And we can move on to the Hurricanes 4, and the Red Wings had 0. The Senators had 2. The Blackhawks had 0. That's where Claude Giroux and Parker Kelly scored. Anton Forsberg had 19 saves, and host Ottawa beat Chicago for its 4th straight win. Islanders had 3. The Panthers, 2. We go to the Penguins, who had 3 over the Blue Jackets, 2. Canadiens, 4. The Flyers, 1. The Blues, 5. The Flames, 3. Wild had 3, and the Sharks had 1. Next game match was the Golden Knights, 4. The Jets, 1. The Oilers, 4, and the Kings, 1. Stars got 3 over the Canucks, 1. Kraken, 4. Ducks, 2. I think it's K-R-A-K-E-N. Kraken or Kraken, I'm not sure. Sorry about that. Then Coyotes, 8. Predators, 4. That's kind of a wrap-up of the hockey scores. You are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call, 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, March 29 of 2024. And on the very top of this front page, the headline is, "When the Lynx, L-Y-N-X, Come Marching In." And there's a Webster City Lynx marching band picture from 1976 is pictured here in their purple and gold uniforms. Pretty good sized band. And the headline reads, "50 Years of Memories Will Converge with April 19 Reunion Weekend." It's written by Colleen Taylor, K-O-L-L-E-E-N. Webster City soon will be filled with the nostalgic sound of music. It will come from reunited Webster City High School band members who will pay homage to their own award-winning marching days under the direction of Jay Nugent. Their reunion will be the weekend of April 19 through 21. The early to late 1970s were an exciting period for the band students of Nugent, who came to Webster City to take over the Webster City High School band program. He first taught in Lorenz and then spent 3 years in the U.S. Army bands. And after his discharge, he enrolled at Drake University to complete a master's degree in music. He taught in Vinton for 2 years. Then he got a call to consider Webster City. Succeeding longtime band instructor Tori Antemuro, Nugent inherited students who were well-trained from Antemuro's devotion to the band program. Between him, Richard Gosch, and Rosetta Nerum, who taught elementary band lessons, the program had a great foundation in Webster City by high school band students had a unique bond and a love for performing, either as concert band members in specialty small groups or in the marching band. It was the only real joyful memories of school, Miriam Nass Carlson said. She is helping to organize the approaching reunion. I remember always feeling at home in the band room, she said. Discussions about a reunion of those band years were battered about as a reunion of the class of 1978 about 6 years ago. The Nugents were invited and attended the reunion as they have for several classes. The memories that surfaced were something they wanted to share with others. The casual discussions continued, but things changed in July of 2023 when a group attended a concert where former WCHS trumpeter Steve Cook was playing with the Al Welsh Orchestra. Carlson, Mike Welsh, Kelly Smith, Peterson, Janie Kuloff-Deaver, Jervita Peterson-Nelson, and Cindy Brzeus Pagburn met at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, and their joyful memories sparked an idea. They wanted to continue the discussion with more band students from that era and scheduled a call to discuss potential reunion. Carlson, Deaver, Peterson, and Pangburn decided they could make it happen. COVID-19 has had us put a reunion on hold, Deaver said, but the first class of Nugent students is now having their 50th reunion this year. We decided this would be a good year to reunite the band students. COVID really brought into focus that we need to plan something to see the people who we shared such great memories with and tell them that we really care about them, she said. Jay and Sherry Nugent, who currently live in Clive, lived in Webster City from 1973 to 1978. They will be attending the reunion and bringing some special guests who students from that era will remember. The Nugents have kept in touch with many students and peers since leaving Webster City, and they are excited about the reunion. Webster City was the finest band I ever had, Nugent said. He left Webster City to work in sales and finance, but returned to directing at East High in Des Moines after an 8-year break. He directed bands in several other high schools, but finally returned to Central Iowa. One of his favorite school bands was Saydell High School. Saydell was similar to Webster City with strong student leadership, he said. Webster City had such wonderful students, such mature leadership, he continued. The jazz band had a real personality. The Wind Ensemble, a smaller select concert band, received number one ratings every year. Nugent was able to combine serious musicians and academics with talented musicians who needed a different approach. His competitive spirit served as an inspiration to his band students. Over the years, he drew on his experiences in Webster City and subsequent schools to take on leadership roles with the Iowa Bandmasters Association, serving as president in 2002 and 2003, in addition to teaching at Simpson College. He formally retired in 2018, but can still be coaxed to help out with occasional projects. In Webster City, Nugent brought a visionary element to the high school band program. During the first year, he started preparing the students to enhance their skills by starting a drum and bugle corps style marching step and adding the flare of flags and intricate patterns on the field. By the first summer in 1974, flags were adding color to the field, and the Webster City Marching Band began competing with other high school marching bands across, or rather around, the state. The marching band performances were organized with sections of four students, with one assigned as the leader of each foursome. Their job was to assure their foursome was marching, playing their music, all in step and in line within their group, and the leader made sure they aligned with the other foursomes. Each section leader would take a leadership role, many for the first time, said Deaver. Kids who were never asked to lead suddenly were, and they rose to the occasion, he said, Deaver said. The band program evolved dramatically during those years. Band students had always competed in all state and honor band programs and usually had a major trip out of state every 3 years to perform as a marching unit. But when the Nugents arrived, the focus changed as the style of marching took more work, and the musical routines delivered more punch and excitement. Travel around the state in school buses, sometimes arriving barely in time for performances, made students become efficient in dressing and getting their instruments ready to compete. We would pull into a town and the buses would park in a square, Deaver recalled. One bus would be used for girls to change clothes, one for boys, and we would change on the buses. The band students would sleep on gym floors and sleeping bags to give maximum time for practice, performances, and travel. The 1974 competition band wore the black and red band uniforms, which had been in use since the mid-1960s. The only skirted member was that of the majorette, who in 1974 was Patsy Anderson Brock. And during the summer of 1974, she was joined with flag bearers wearing black turtlenecks, flared black skirts, and carrying tall, heavy poles to unfurl flags during the band routines. New uniforms were in the plans by the second semester, and in April of 1975, the purple and gold uniforms debuted at the Iowa State University Visha Parade. The competitions during those years were intense and thrilling to watch. When the tide began to turn toward Webster City, earning the highest marks, the enthusiasm for the band program intensified. Their rise was quick. At their first competition, the Mid-Iowa Marching Band Competition in the summer of 74, they earned a fifth-place finish. By the fall of 74, they earned second place at the Old Wine Marching Band Invitational and a 1 rating at the State Marching Band Contest. During 1975, a jazz band was organized. It competed at jazz festivals around Iowa. Starting at the bottom of the pack, the Webster City Band program began earning higher marks, and with those marks, greater recognition as the years continued. The band students didn't want to just compete. They wanted to excel. The list of awards earned during those years demonstrated their dedication and drew the attention of out-of-state venues. A favorite memory and highlight was performing at the Minnesota Vikings football game in the fall of 1977. Although the classmates from the class of 78 took on the task of organizing the approaching reunion, the Nugents have been heavily involved. They contributed names of band contacts from each of those classes that they had connected with over the years. Currently, about 100 band members will be reuniting on that weekend. The weekend will involve a social evening at the Seneca Street Saloon, 919 Seneca Street on Friday, April 19. There will be a coffee on Saturday morning, April 20, at the Kendall Young Library, 1201 Wilson Avenue, and an open house on Sunday, April 22, at the Ed Prince Building on the Hamilton County Fairgrounds. These are all open to the public. Excuse me. Also, during the weekend, band members are invited but not required to bring instruments and rehearse together. During the afternoon on Saturday, a group photo will be taken with an evening banquet including a jazz band performance. A Sunday morning brunch will wrap up the band activities. Those planning to attend the Saturday evening banquet and Sunday morning brunch still have time to reserve a place for either or both. Note, the banquet has been moved to the St. Thomas Aquinas Parish Hall, 1000 Des Moines Street at 6:30 p.m. on April 20. The final open house will be from noon until 2 p.m. April 21 at the Ed Prince Building on the Hamilton County Fairgrounds. For more information, you can visit the Facebook page J. Nugent Band Reunion 4/20/24. Also on the front page, this article, accused killer found incompetent for trial. Appeals court ruling stops prosecution of Fort Dodge Man, written by Bill Shea. Fort Dodge man accused of killing a man in 2021 by cutting his throat has been found incompetent to stand trial by the Iowa Court of Appeals. The court ruling will result in the prosecution of Lukoks. If I pronounce that right, I'm not sure. Lukoks A. Brown, beginning put on hold indefinitely. He will be returned to the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Oakdale. Says, we find the preponderance of the evidence shows that Brown remains incompetent to stand trial, but is making progress in regaining competency. Three-judge panel of the court wrote in a 24-page ruling. Attorneys for Brown filed an appeal after Wright County District Court Judge Greg R. Rosenblatt found him competent to stand trial on June 17, 2022. In making that decision, Rosenblatt agreed with the findings of an expert witness hired by the state and set aside the findings of a team of psychiatrists from the Iowa Medical and Classification Center who had worked with Brown for months. Brown, 29 years old, is accused of killing Wayne Smith, 50, of Fort Dodge on February 16, 2021, in a locker room in the Prestige Foods of Iowa plant near Eagle Grove. Investigators and prosecutors said Brown cut Smith's throat with a knife. Brown was charged with first-degree murder. His defense attorneys very quickly questioned Brown's competency to stand trial. In their ruling, the appellate court judges wrote that the defense attorneys reported that Brown exhibited an abnormal thought process, stated he had been hearing voices, appeared to respond to outside stimuli that were not present in reality, and stated that he had previously had an inpatient hospitalization for a schizophrenia diagnosis, they said. Well, on Monday, May 17, 2021, Brown was sent to the Iowa Medical and Classification Center. According to the recently released Court of Appeals ruling, the staff there diagnosed Brown with major neurocognitive disorder and found him incapable of following a trial or assisting his attorneys. In January 2022, the facility staff reported that he could not be restored to competency in a reasonable amount of time with any known treatments. A hearing was held before Rosenblatt within 14 days of the facility's report being issued. At that hearing, the judge gave prosecutors the opportunity to hire their own expert to examine Brown. After receiving the report of the state's expert, Rosenblatt ruled that Brown was competent to stand trial, prompting the appeal. In their ruling, the appellate court judges sent the case back to the district court level with instructions to suspend the criminal proceedings indefinitely and send Brown back to the Iowa Medical and Classification Center. Article headline is Widespread Rains Ease Drought in Western Iowa, written by Jared Strong, Iowa Capital Dispatch. There was significant rainfall in the past week across the northwest half of the state, with much of that area receiving at least 2 inches of precipitation, according to the National Weather Service. That helped reverse drought conditions that have been pestering Iowa for more than 3 years. The state's overall dryness is now comparable to what it was in August, before it accelerated to a new peak last fall, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. About 71% of the state is suffering from some measure of drought, down from nearly all of the state at its worst. But Iowa is still substantially drier than a year ago, when less than a third of the state had drought. Small areas of central Iowa had at least 4 inches of precipitation in the past week. A portion of far southeast Iowa had less than half an inch, but that area has also been wetter than the rest of the state. Some of it has no drought or dryness designation. The driest area in the northeast quadrant of the state that has extreme drought, the second to worst classification, shrunk by about a third in the past week. Drought is expected to persist there into the summer, according to the Federal Climate Prediction Center, but it should continue to ease in the southwest half of the state. The recent rains have been a boon to rivers in western Iowa, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Nearly all of those rivers it monitors have normal or above normal flows. An example, the surface of the North Raccoon River near Jefferson has risen about 4 feet since the start of the week. And the Iowa House passes eminent domain bill for pipelines, written by Jared Strong. A bill approved by the Iowa House on Thursday would allow landowners who are subject to eminent domain requests by carbon dioxide pipeline companies to challenge the legitimacy of those requests in court earlier in the permit proceedings. House File 2664 was approved by a bipartisan 86-7 vote. Its future in the Senate is unclear. It is the latest attempt by the House to aid landowners who object to Summit Carbon Solutions' proposed use of eminent domain to build a sprawling pipeline system that would transport captured carbon dioxide from 30 ethanol plants in Iowa to North Dakota for underground storage. If the Iowa Utilities Board grants the company's request, landowners who have refused to negotiate easements for the project voluntarily would have to give up the land use at a price set by a government board. A bill the House adopted last year would have required Summit to obtain voluntary land easements for 90% of its route before being eligible for eminent domain. The Senate did not take it up. The new bill the House approved Thursday would not itself limit eminent domain for the pipeline projects. It is meant to expedite a court decision about whether eminent domain is allowable, a decision that under current rules might come many months after state regulators issued a permit. The bill would allow court challenges before permits are issued at the request of affected landowners or the companies that propose the projects. For that entire period, you have the Century Farms landowners, people who didn't especially want to have this pipeline going over their land and have some questions about it, not being able to get an answer on their constitutional law question and not being able to sell their land at full value or make a decision on tiling or make a decision on estate planning for all that period of time, said Representative Charlie Thompson, a Republican of Charles City, who is an attorney and managed the bill. This bill corrects that, he said. Summit began its pipeline permit process with the Iowa Utilities Board in August of 2021. A year later, in August 2022, it began notifying the Board of Properties that might be subject to its eminent domain request. Now, about 19 months later, the Board is poised to decide those requests, which represent about a quarter of its initial route in Iowa. The board has declined, say, whether Summit's project benefits the public in a way that makes it eligible for eminent domain. This legislation simply allows both landowners and companies the opportunity to have a declaratory judgment up front on the constitutionality of an eminent domain request before precious time and money are wasted, said Representative Stephen Holt, a Republican of Denison, who has been a leading voice against eminent domain for carbon dioxide pipelines. This legislation would allow landowners a little peace of mind getting to know up front the validity of an eminent domain request so that they could plan accordingly, as opposed to waiting and fighting for years. Their land in limbo, their futures in doubt, their lives full of tension and fear, while they plead with their elected officials to hear them, he said. The legislation is opposed by Summit, the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, and several biofuels companies, according to lobbyist declarations. The Iowa Farm Bureau Federation did not declare its opposition or support. Seven House Republicans voted against the bill: Michael Bergen of Decorah, Tom Ditterman of Clinton, Chad Engels of Randalia, Brian Loesch of Bondurant, Norlin Momsen of DeWitt, Matt Rinker of Burlington, and David Siek, of Glenwood. The scope of Summit's project has expanded in recent months after another company, Navigator CO2, abandoned a similar proposal. That has led Summit to ink agreements with most of the ethanol plants that had intended to connect to the Navigator system. Summit's proposal has grown to about 2,500 miles of pipe in five states to transport carbon dioxide from 57 ethanol plants. Company was initially denied permits by state regulators in the Dakotas, but North Dakota is reconsidering a modified plan. Summit has said it will reapply in South Dakota with a different route. I'm going to go to obituaries right now. We only have three. And Lane M. Carlson, Fort Dodge, was 82, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Wednesday at the Simpson Health Center at Friendship Haven. Arrangements are currently pending with Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Ann Galbraith, Sac City, memorial service for Ann, 90 Years Old of Sac City will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th at Farber and Ottoman Funeral Home in Sac City. Visitation 1 hour prior to service. If you want more information, Faber Ottoman, FaberOttoman.com is where to go. And Stephen Vogt, Lauraville. Memorial is at 10:30 a.m. Saturday at UMC, Lauraville, Iowa. Burial in the Evergreen Cemetery, Lauraville. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at the UMC in Lauraville. And more information, go to Powers, PowersFH.net. Moving to the sports section, and there's a picture here. It says, Robert Jones of Iowa State reacts after scoring against Illinois during an NCAA tournament game on Thursday night in Boston, and he is happy he made that shot. However, Illinois holds off Cyclones to advance in the tournament. This is written by Kyle Hightower of the Associated Press. Terrence Shannon Jr. scored 29 points, and Illinois reached the Elite Eight for the first time since 2005, beating Iowa State 72-69 in an East Region semifinal on Thursday night. Shannon had 20 points in the first half for the third-seeded Illini, 29-8, who never trailed. He broke away for a dunk in the closing seconds and later hit two free throws to help Illinois finally put away the second-seeded Cyclones, 29-8. Illinois made a regional final for the fourth time in the past 40 years and will meet defending champion UConn on Saturday for a trip to the Final Four. The top-seeded Huskies defeated San Diego State 82-52 in an earlier semifinal. Curtis Jones scored 26 points to lead Iowa State, which came into March Madness having blown out Houston for the Big 12 tournament title. Keyshawn Gilbert added 14 points and Trey King 12. And Dresser is Big 12 Coach of the Year. Iowa State head wrestling coach Kevin Dresser has been named the Big 12 Coach of the Year, the league announced on Thursday. And this marks the second time in his seven seasons. Dresser, a graduate of Humboldt High School and former North Central Conference champion, has received the honor. And Tucker DeVries will play for Dad at West Virginia. He sat in the front row for his father's introductory news conference Thursday as Darian announced that his son, the two-time reigning Missouri Valley Conference Player of the Year, is joining him with the Mountaineers. That might have drawn the loudest cheer from hundreds of West Virginia fans ready to move on from a year of misery. Here's what is on TV you might be interested in. Time and Channel, a men's NCAA tournament, Sweet 16, North Carolina State versus Marquette, 6 p.m. on CBS. Gonzaga versus Purdue, 6:30 p.m. TBS and TRU. Duke versus Houston, 8:30 p.m. on CBS. And Creighton versus Tennessee, 9 p.m., TBS and True. And the women's NCAA tournament, Sweet 16. We've got Oregon State versus Notre Dame, 1:30 p.m. on ESPN. Indiana versus South Carolina, 4 p.m. on ESPN. North Carolina State versus Stanford, 6:30 p.m. on ESPN. Gonzaga versus Texas, 9 p.m. on ESPN. And let's see here. The NCAA Division II Women's Championship, Minnesota State versus Texas Women's, 7 p.m. on CBSSN. And here's another note that Northern Iowa National Champion Parker Kekaisen has been named the 2024 Big 12 Conference's Wrestler of the Year, as it was announced by the league office on Thursday. And we'll end with this little note. On this date in 1976, Indiana beats Michigan 86-68 to complete a perfect season and win the NCAA title. So, folks, that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. I want to thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and I wish you a great day.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing. It really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.